Deyanira Chavez came to the U.S. when she was 12. Her mother brought her and her brothers and sister from Mexico to North Carolina, hoping for a better life. Deyanira entered seventh grade with what she called a mission to do as well in school as she possibly could, to go on to college, to be the success that her mother was seeking. And she almost did it. She made it all the way to college to an exclusive architecture program, but her status as an illegal resident and the resulting high cost of her tuition brought it all to an end when she was forced to drop out.
Once you get a taste for a good thing, like once you know that you really like something and you're good at it and that you want to fulfill your dream of, you know, becoming, you know, an architect or anything like that, and that you were really close to it, but then you're denied that, it's just, it kind of destroys your dreams.
Deyanira Chavez says she's still not sure what will become of her dreams. But hers is the face of America's current confusion over immigration. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Across the country, legislators and educators are wrestling with the same question. What kind of college education should be offered to students who are undocumented, students without the legal papers to live here? If you're in Nebraska, you get a break. Undocumented students can go to state colleges at the resident rate of tuition. North Carolina is at the other end of the spectrum. Students without papers must pay the full out-of-state tuition. What's more, community colleges have just decided that these so-called illegal immigrants will no longer even be admitted into degree programs. The most curious feature of this whole puzzle is that these same students all get free and easy access to public education when they're younger. But even those who wind up as top students can then be pushed aside. That's what happened to Deyanira Chavez. Her mother brought her across the border from Mexico when she was 12. In that first year in school, Deyanira was barely able to speak English, but like every other student, she was called up to the chalkboard to do problems, to learn.
If I was in English class and I had to stand up on the board, I was really nervous and, you know, like stressed out. But if it was math, it came really easy to me at that time because it was the only, like the class where I didn't have to know the words. I just had to look at the problem and solve it. And I could do that. It made me feel proud and I went into a focus. Like I felt that if I was in this country and my mom wanted to work towards getting something better for a family, that my mission was to do well in school.
So
it was like a mission, like I had to do good in school because that's what I'm here to do.
Deyanira, if you were working that hard on homework and schoolwork, you must have been getting some pretty good grades.
I did. I've been mostly in like an A student, a couple of B's and then, you know, here and there. It was something that I was really proud of. I could show it to my mom and be like, Mom, here are my grades, and I'm doing great. And
what did your mother say? Did it make a big difference to her that you were getting these grades, that you were doing so well in school?
Yes, but I would think that if any other family, they would be like, oh, this is my kid, like, she's getting excellent grades, and for my mother, I think it was mostly like a relief, like, oh, she's not getting into trouble. She's not doing anything that I have to, you know, worry about. Like, she's doing great in here, and she likes it.
Sort of like she didn't have to push you because you were already pushing yourself?
Yes.
High school was a different challenge for Deyanira Chavez. She was no longer in her English as a second language classes. She was now expected to write her English essays along with all the others. She used to dread seeing all the grammar corrections.
Because I would turn in, like, my essay in all white, like, white paper, and then I would always get it back with, like, red ink with all the errors, and it always frustrated me because I was like, I can't do better than I try. Like, I really did try my best, and I'm still getting back this. It's just too many, the way that I worded things, it was the way I think and not the way it was supposed to be written down. So it was really confusing for me because I'd be like, but that's what I'm trying to say. I can't. If I write it the other way, then it won't be the same. So I couldn't understand that, like how to make that transition.
Were you getting help from teachers, though? Did you find that the teachers in high school, once they got to know you, they were helping you out as well when they saw that you were trying?
All of my teachers have always been helpful because they always ask me, is English like your second language? And when they knew it was my second language, they were a little more patient too.
And how about friends in high school? Did you find that you were getting a group of friends while you were there?
I always had like very little friends, but it was because I was be so focused on work. If I was not satisfied with the way my work ended, like in the night before, I would correct it in the morning so I wouldn't be out in the hall talking to people. I would just be in the classroom waiting until the class started and, you know, finish up my homework or getting it right, studying vocabulary or reading a book. So it was probably into junior when I actually started talking to a lot of more people, and they were like, well, you're always in the library or you're always in classroom. We're like, what do you do? And people had like crazy ideas of what I did, like she must be really serious or she's not fun or anything. I was like, well, it's not that. I mean, I just always had something to do, and mostly to get focused or not to be distracted. I always did it by myself, but it wasn't that I was like something like a ghost story or.
Dayanira, did you have a part-time job while you were in high school?
I did. I started working as a waitress, and sometimes I would help out around like banquets.
What were you doing with your wages and your tips? Were you saving it?
I saved it, and I usually bought I bought myself a computer, printer, stuff that I thought I needed, but I felt that I couldn't ask my mom. Like, I couldn't be like, Mom, I need a computer, you know, like, I want a computer, because I knew she was like paying the rent and getting us food. So, and I'm not an only child, so I think like my brothers would be like, well, what about me, you know?
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Dayanira Chavez was often the only undocumented immigrant in her classes. No one knew how much her mother worked. No one talked about the fact that her family was from Mexico. Her fellow students were aware, though, of the national debate over immigration. It came out once in one of her classes.
The story goes like this, I guess. I was in the classroom. It was social studies. And the teacher made a mistake of asking, if you're going to eliminate any race, which one would it be? You know, I personally think that question was out of place, but...
so do I.
Yeah. He made it, so one of the kids answered, and I was standing right in front of her, and she's like, oh, Mexicans. And I was like, okay. A lot of it, like, the classroom just kind of went silent, and then like, ooh, you know? But it wasn't, like, I don't think it was something against me.
It's pretty cold, though.
You get moments like that or you hear things, but I usually try not to pay attention or not be confrontational to anybody because that just would get me into more trouble.
When Dayanira Chavez was nearing the end of her time in high school, things were looking up for the children of illegal immigrants. Congress was debating a law that would give legal status to those who served in the military or attended college. They called it the DREAM Act, and that's what it was for Dayanira.
It was kind of like my hope. At that time, I was like, oh, this is great. I can continue to get higher education. I wouldn't have to worry about my status. I wouldn't have to feel that I'm hiding something. Or it was just, I was really excited about it. One time in my English class, we had a research paper, and I did mine on the DREAM Act. I looked up a lot of information, and I did a speech to... all the Latinos in my high school.
It started as a
research project. After that, I told my counselor. I always had a good relationship with her, so I asked my counselor. I was like, I would really like to teach my classmates and everybody in school about this, and you know, get them excited about the DREAM Act, so they'll do good in school, and they can show like they can show that they have what it takes, that they just need an opportunity. And I was really passionate about this when I was in high school. It was one of the things I wanted to do. And I talked to my principal about it, and he gave me a chance to talk to the Latino community in my school, and I did.
How many kids were you talking to at that time?
It was probably around 40 kids.
Uh-huh. It sounds to me, Danir, that you developed a lot of confidence while you were a high school student.
I did. It was, I had a lot of good role models.
Deyanira Chavez graduated from high school with the class of 2004. It's a day she remembers well.
I received a lot of awards. I received one that kind of like passed the other ones because it was an honor to receive it. I received the Principal Medals Award for talking to my peers about the DREAM Act and getting them informed and involved in something that would probably benefit not only them but the whole community.
So like a community service award, is that what it is?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Congratulations.
My principal thought that, you know, it took courage to come in and talk to him and ask him to do that for my peers and everything. So I didn't expect it. I wasn't expecting that. So it was a surprise. But the best part of it was when they gave it to me, you know, I was really happy. But as I turned around to go back to my seat, I saw my senior classes standing up for me.
All of them?
Yes.
That's great.
Yeah, it was really special.
Did you cry?
Yes. That was the best of any award that I could have received because it was just, you just feel, it's something you feel like you get the respect of your peers and I guess it was something I looked for and that I didn't know how to get. Like I didn't go into sports or anything like that, so it was something almost like magic, you know, like you don't expect that, and when they see you and they're standing up for you and they're clapping for you, I think it's something that you never forget.
The next thing on Deyanira Chavez's mind was going on to college. She had won a coveted spot in a state architecture program, and she'd worked to gather up scholarships because it was going to cost her thousands of dollars. However, this chapter of Deyanira's American Dream doesn't have such a happy ending, and I'll talk with her about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. It was this time of year, 4 years ago, when Deyanira Chavez graduated from high school to face a problem that thousands of other kids like her confront. Deyanira was born in Mexico and raised in the U.S. She entered the country illegally with her mother. And although she was welcomed into the public school system in North Carolina, she would have to pay out-of-state tuition if she was going to go on to college. And Deyanira was determined not to quit.
Starting senior year, everybody asked questions like, where are you going to go to college? And, you know, with your grades, you can go anywhere. And I'll be like, well, my grades, yes, they can get me anywhere. My status, no. On that other hand, I usually didn't talk about it with other kids because I just didn't have an answer for them or I didn't want to tell them. What I wanted to do is go into architecture. So we started looking to schools that had architecture programs. And there was, you know, this kind of feeling like, well, you might get in, you might not get in. I we didn't know anything about it. My counselor didn't have a case like that before, so we had to do like trial and error. And you always have this feeling like, well, you might not be allowed to do that, so we're just gonna try it. And I was accepted to the architecture program in UNC Charlotte.
Do you remember the day when UNC Charlotte wrote and said you're in?
Actually, I got the letter and, you know, I just couldn't believe it. I think I screamed like crazy, like, yay, because I just couldn't believe that I was actually going to go there and study and that I was actually accepted into the program. To that program, a lot of people apply, but only 50 applicants get to go in.
Okay, let me just go through a couple of things quickly here. Because you're an undocumented resident, because you don't have a Social Security number, because you came into the country illegally with your mother when you were a little girl, that means that you can't get in-state tuition, even at a state college like UNC Charlotte. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So what was the tuition going to be just for your first year in that architecture program there?
On your first year, you had to live there, and altogether it's going to add up to $20,000.
Wow.
That doesn't include your materials. Like, I had to get a lot of materials for architecture, and that price is not included there. Like, you actually have to go buy paper, I get rulers, it gets rather expensive as well, so.
Danir, was it possible for you to get any kind of financial help, any scholarships or any bursaries? Were you eligible for that kind of assistance?
My first year, there were scholarships for students who are getting out of high school into college, and I got a couple of those. I also got the Latino Diamante Award, in which came with a scholarship, and my school gave me scholarships too, so that's how I got in and paid him money for, like, the first semester, I guess. And
so your scholarship money added up to what, about $10,000? Is that right?
I think a little bit less.
Yeah.
Might have been.
But you were going to have to come up with the rest.
Yes.
Now, could you get a student loan being undocumented?
If somebody said, oh, yes, I can, you know, put my house and as a collateral, and yes, I'll sign a
With property has to do it.
Yeah, someone with credit. Uh-huh. And I think it'll be like the hardest part is that it had to be out of state tuition. So it'll be like, you know, like $40,000 or maybe more. So, and again, that would include any of the materials that I would need to finish my career. So it was actually looking pretty tough.
But you started the program. You began mm-hmm. your first year. Even when you started, Danir, were you thinking, I can do this, I can find the money somewhere? Or were you even worried at that time?
I was too excited. I was thrilled to be there. I felt that I found people that were like me, that they were interested in the same things, interested in drawing and created something just out of their mind. And it was just a different culture. Like, once you're in studio and you take those classes, you start speaking a different language.
And how were you doing as a student? Were you doing well?
I was doing very well. I was one of the students that had the highest grades in my class again. So I spent most of my time in studio and getting everything ready. So
you were having fun?
Yes, I had a lot of fun. My first semester, I was really happy to be there. I felt that that's what I needed to do, that I came here to Earth. Like, I came here to study architecture, and I'm going to be an architect, and I'm going to build great projects. And, you know, it was everything I wanted to do.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Danir Chavez was also making friends easily at college, but her financial difficulties became all too evident very early on.
At the end of that first semester, they told me, well, you know, you pay for first semester, but you need to come up with the second semester. And it was really frustrating to realize that I wasn't going to have enough money to stay there. And it was really hard. I went into depression. Like, I just felt that I failed. I felt that I didn't accomplish what I went to get there. And it was just really hard for me.
Was there anything that you could do to try to raise the money just to make it through your first year?
We actually did. We talked to friends.
We being sister, who? You and your family?
Me and my family, yes. And a lot of people gave me financial aid, just people that I knew.
What, they gave you money?
Yeah, like, they just tried to help me out that way. My sister did a raffle. We bought a digital camera, and we made a bunch of tickets to raise money too. We raised like $500 from that camera. My mom and my sister gave me a lot of money, too, so I could stay there.
And all the time you know that you're not really likely to have the money for your second year?
Yes. We talked about this with the head of the college. She told me she wanted to help me out. We looked for scholarships, but I think we came to realize that if my career was in education or law, or maybe a medical field, that the scholarships were just not there due to my status.
You mean you could possibly have got scholarship money if you were studying to be a doctor or a nurse or a lawyer, but you couldn't get that same help to study architecture?
No. If you're not in that field, then you don't apply. You don't qualify for that scholarship.
And you might have qualified for those scholarships even as an undocumented person?
Some of them, yes.
Yeah, okay. Do you remember the time, the day, when you realized, that's it, I'm not going to be able to continue on in college?
I tried to postpone it until the last of the semester. I think when I moved out, it was my classmates are coming back and I'm not. And the head of the college told me once that from all of the kids in the program, she could see that I deserved to be there, that I was one of the best, but there wasn't a way she could help me.
Did you talk to your classmates on that day when you were moving out?
I talked to a lot of them. Some of them were really sympathetic, and one of them actually got he asked for signatures and everybody in the first grade and sent it to, I think, his congressman, telling about that I was a really good student and that it would be a really good thing if I was to keep my education there. And that was really special. And they could see that I really wanted to be there and that I wasn't going back the next year.
And how hard was it for you to go home, to go back to Asheville?
It was really hard because I felt that it was sort of my fault that I couldn't do it. And it was just really frustrating because once you get a taste for a good thing, once you know that you really like something and you're good at it and that you want to fulfill your dream of, becoming, an architect or anything like that, and that you were really close to it, but then you're denied that. It kind of destroys your dreams. And you feel incomplete. You feel what is the point then? What is the point of doing good in school or just, what am I trying to get?
Who did you blame?
I can't understand why. It's just difficult to understand that you're just a passenger like that. At what point you have to get off? And the point is that it's just very political. That if you don't have a number, that if you weren't born here, then it's just not for you. Your piece of pie is not for you. You can look at it, but you may even get to taste it, but it's the end is not going to be for you.
Daniel, I wonder if at any point after you came back to Asheville, after your year at college, were you ever angry with your mother? Did you ever say, Mom, why did you bring me to this country where I'm not going to get the chance? Even if I work hard, I can't go to the college that I want to go to. I'm not going to be accepted here.
No, I see that she tried to help me the best she could. And I had to understand that she was in the same situation that I was. And that together as a family, our choices were limited. I wanted to ask her, help me out. I can't do this alone. And that I couldn't put that much pressure on her, too. I would know I would make her feel bad. And even if I did, it wasn't going to get me anywhere.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Deyanira Chavez was so determined to continue her study of architecture that she thought about going back to Mexico, where she was born. But even that option presented its own problems.
I thought about it. We talked about it with my family, and we actually started looking into a way of if I was going to do that, how I was going to go about it. I asked family members that live back there, and it turns out that because I didn't graduate from school in Mexico, that I actually had to pay out of state as well. So either way, if I stay here, I had to pay out of state. If I go to Mexico, I had to pay out of state. On top of that, I had to go back and complete some of the courses that are taken here, like history right. and Spanish, because I can speak and write Spanish, but my vocabulary and everything, they wanted to be at a college level. So I had to learn a lot of things and retake a lot of the courses that I've taken here. So...
Not a great plan. What have you been doing since?
I kept my studies by going to Blue Ridge Community College, and it's kind of like a B plan. can sort of give me a base to go back. I also thought of getting maybe another career, something that I can get scholarships on.
How does Blue Ridge Community College compare to UNC Charlotte?
Blue Ridge Community College or Oregon Community College, I think at some point it turns into a continuation of high school. The kids are there to keep their education, but at the same point they really don't know if they want to be a doctor or if they want to be, so it's a lot of like laid back. It just feels like there's not a focus for one thing, and it was very different compared to the studio and the classes that I was at UNC Charlotte. There was a drive there, everybody was on the same page, everybody wanted to do good and even at some point compete against each other to see who would do better.
I understand that, Deonera, but even when you were in high school, you were the one who pushed yourself. Can you not do that community college? Can you not say, okay, well, maybe the teacher doesn't care that much if I'm here, but I'm going to get the best grade I can. I'm going to work as hard as I can.
I think that, like, I'm still getting good grades, but it's still different. I took drawing classes, and I did excellent there. I also had, like, some of my drawings showing in an art gallery. But you still have to make that for yourself. And the difference between the UNC Charlotte and the community college is that the atmosphere is created for you in UNC Charlotte. People who speak the same vocabulary, people who are there to do and learn the same things that you are, people who are similar goals, and they're there to work.
Deonera, tell me something. In the last few years that you've been away from college, what's the worst moment that you've had?
I think there's a fear of I'm not getting back there. Like, you feel like, am I gonna make it? Am I gonna go back and finish what I started? Am I gonna get that dream? Am I gonna finish it? Am I gonna see it through? Or am I gonna become somebody who gets up in the morning and goes to work and does something because she has to pay the bills? You know, even though she didn't complete getting her degree in architecture, that was her dream. Am I going to be somebody who feels sort of emptiness and a frustration that I couldn't be that?
And what do you think? Have you given up on your dream of becoming an architect?
No, I haven't. One of my teachers says that it took him 13 years to actually get his degree, and that sometimes it can be a wavy road. And I like to think that it's a wavy road, and I'm going to get there.
Do you still do your drawing?
Yeah, I continue to draw. It was one of the decisions that I wanted to keep my skill up so it doesn't become rusty, and I need to keep that alive.
And what kind of building would you design for me?
I would probably go into residential. I'd probably design your house.
And what would you put in my house that would be different, that would be the Deonera touch?
Light. I would focus on light, getting space, you know, where you don't feel trapped, that you don't feel very in touch with nature as well. When you get home, you feel calm, you feel that you can be in two places at the same time. You know, you can see the landscape and everything outside, but you're in your side, your house. It's the type of architecture that I actually want to explore.
Deonera.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give up.
I won't.
Deonera Chavez joined me from WCQS, the public radio studio in Asheville, North Carolina. If you have some thoughts about Deianira's story, or a perspective of your own that you'd like to tell me about, you can get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
1-2. Hit in the air to deep right center field. Hit it toward the wall. That ball is out of here! Out of here! The Mets win the ball game!
The slide into summer baseball season these days is most often captured by the big, bright colors of a widescreen TV. Well, it used to be that the color of baseball lived on the radio. Jim Trelease wrote in to tell me about his lifelong love for the game and his admiration for one announcer and one team, Vin Scully and the Dodgers.
Dave lines it down the left field line, in there for a base hit. Matsui over and over runs the ball, and it goes all the way down to the box seat. Look out, there's a rabbit loose. Here comes Robert. Here's Jesus Flow. He scores!
Jim Trelease and his brother listened to games and to the announcer back when they were kids, back in the mid-50s.
Had a radio attached to our bunk bed, and so we could control the little transistor radio in the dark with our just leaning over the edge and twisting the dial. You had to depend upon the announcer to paint the word picture of the game for you. You turned over your disbelief to this person, and you trusted them to paint you an accurate picture.
And the man you listened to was Vin Scully. Tell me about listening to his voice.
Scully had a timbre to his voice that was just special. He had a way of doing a game where he didn't exaggerate. He didn't need the hype that you sometimes heard from a homer. When the other kids in my neighborhood were playing stickball, and I'm doing play-by-play. I mean, I'm playing. I'm in the outfield, but you know, I'm saying Bobby Snyder is at the plate, hits a long drive to center field, going back to the wall, it's gone. Well, that was Scully, and that was me doing Scully at West End School in 1954.
Could the catcher 65. Hear you from the outfield?
Oh, yeah, they all knew. They thought this guy was nuts in the outfield, but they put up with me. They just knew I wanted to be Scully.
One game that Jim Trelease remembers was in June 1957. It was during the Dodgers' last season in Brooklyn. And Vin Scully found time to highlight a hometown connection.
Well, the second string catcher recently had stitches in his hand, which meant the third string catcher was going to have to play. Well, most of us didn't know who the third string catcher was when you have the great Roy Campanella catching. And it turns out it was the bullpen catcher, the guy who went out in the bullpen and caught for the pitchers who were warming up. And it was a young guy named Joe Pignatano. And Pignatano had never caught a major league game. And so as Scully looks ahead to this, he's thinking that Pignatano's going to make his debut behind the plate. He also is factoring in what he knew about this young local, and Pignatano was from Brooklyn,
yeah.
Family. His wife had recently had a baby. And what he did was announce, folks, if you know the Pignatano family,
if you do,
why don't you give him a call?
Maybe his wife taking care of the baby, not watching or listening to the ball game. Give her a call. Looks like Joe's going to break into the major leagues tonight.
He wanted to make sure that they didn't miss Joe's debut as a major league catcher.
Jim Trelease grew up in a family where there wasn't a lot of money. The idea of going all the way from Jersey to actually see a Dodgers game at Ebbets Field in Brooklyn was out of the question. But a few months after the Dodgers played their last game in New York, Jim got his chance. It was his junior year of high school, and the nuns at his school were leading a field trip to New York.
So before it was torn down, I was going to make my visit to Mecca, so to speak. Well, as soon as I noticed they weren't looking, I made my way out the door to a subway. And all I was going to do initially, Dick, was to just put my hand on Ebbets Field, just touch the building, and then I'd get back to the subway and leave. When I get there, I find a door that's ajar. So I go into Ebbets Field, I get out onto the field itself, and there's a thin blanket of snow out on the field. I can hear workers up in the rafters working, doing stuff. And I walk out on the field, and I stand where Robinson would have stood and Snyder. And I mean, I really felt as though I had somehow visited this holy shrine, and I could hear the echoes of the crowd.
Was there a moment when you thought about doing a little Vin Scully while you're standing there in Ebbets Field?
You know, I don't think I did. I was just so afraid that someone was going to catch me. I didn't want to make any unnecessary noises out there because I didn't want to be thrown out unceremoniously. So I get to the dugout, and the door is open between the dugout into the tunnel into the locker room. So I go into the Dodger locker room, and the labels are still on the lockers. Reese, Ferrullo, Snyder, and 16-year-old Catholic school kid, I never think to swipe the labels off the lockers. It never occurs to me.
For your kids' college education, probably.
What a treasure they would be today. Never mind the money, just the treasure of having these things
You're
in
right.
my hand.
You're right.
So as I'm leaving the building, I pass a pile of garbage. It's about 8-9 feet tall. And on top of this pile is a box. I lift it. It's full. I retrieve it, stick it under my coat, and I run out and down the block. I have taken a ream of Brooklyn Dodger stationery, brand new, 500 pages, 500 sheets.
Okay.
So I get back to Columbia. Nobody has missed me. Now, what is a 16-year-old kid going to do with 500 sheets of Brooklyn Dodger stationery, which, by the way, are no longer legitimate because there's no such thing as the Brooklyn Dodgers. It's now the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Yeah, but it's history you're holding in your hands, right?
I mean, I didn't think of it in those terms. I'm just wondering, what can I do with this? And then a few nights before April 1st, it dawns on me, this would be a great April Fool's joke. I could type a letter to myself from the Dodgers informing myself that I will be broadcasting games in 1958 the whole summer with Vin Scully, that the Dodgers have picked me out of thousands of high school kids all over the United States, and I'm going to be the Dodger announcer with Scully that summer. It took me three nights of typing this without making errors before I got it what I hope was perfect. I bring it into school on April 1st, and I had one nun who had a particular sense of humor that I thought would get a kick out of it, and that was Sister James Francis. So I bring it in. Beginning of the period, I hand it to her. I said, Sister, I thought you'd like to see this. And I go down. I take my seat.
Hang on a second. What exactly does the letter say? It invites you, Jim Trelease, to be the co-announcer with Vin Scully. Who signed the
right.
letter?
Oh, I invented some signal. I even had Walter O'Malley, the owner of the Dodgers,
okay.
sign the thing, all right? And so now I take my seat. Rest of the class comes in. Sister's up there reading the letter, looks down at me, beams, wonderful smile, mouths congratulations, gives the class an assignment. And I lose track of her. I start to do the assignment with the class, and I'm thinking, well, I'll tell her at the end of class that it's April Fool's. I look up in a few minutes. She's back in the doorway of the class, smiling down at me, and the intercom clicks on. And it's the principal. And she proceeds to read to the entire student body this letter that I have faked on April Fool's Day. Sister James Francis looks from the doorway down to me, sees the expression on my face, and realizes something is terribly wrong here.
What are you thinking at this moment?
I'm thinking that my days in this school are numbered. I have just helped this very stiff, strict principal make a fool of herself in front of the entire faculty and student body. And I walk up the aisle to Sister James Francis, who's in the doorway, and I said, "Sister, I don't know how to tell you this, but this is April Fool's." And she doesn't say anything for a couple seconds, and then she said, "Mr. Trelease, you don't think for a second that I'm going to be the one to tell her. Mister, get walking." And I have to walk down this highly polished Catholic school corridor.
All by yourself.
All by myself. I mean, it's like the walk from death row to the chamber. And Sister Mary Eugene, who was the principal, she had a look. And all she had to do was look at you with that look. And I have to go down and tell her that the whole thing was a joke. And when I did that, a friendship began between the two of us. I realized for the first time she had a sense of humor. And we were fast friends from then on, right into her retirement years. But it all worked out perfectly. Scully and I had this, I guess, an appointment of destiny that would be, you know, like 39 years in coming.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Jim Trelease went on with his life. He wrote a best-selling book, and one day, years later, happened to be doing a public presentation in the West Coast hometown of his hero, Vin Scully. And at the podium, Jim said,
"You know, I'm a little disappointed in you folks here in Pacific Palisades. I came here today knowing that my childhood hero lived here, so I came 2 hours early. I drove all around town figuring I'd see him taking out the garbage, and I didn't see him for even a second. The least you could do is have him out on public display for me." And then I smiled and I said, "Vin Scully." Oh, they all said, "Oh, wonderful, wonderful guy." And then I went on with my presentation, and I forgot about it. I didn't give it another thought. But there was a woman sitting in this audience. I didn't know her. She didn't introduce herself to me that night, but she took that little piece of information that Vin Scully was my childhood hero, and she tucked it away in her memory bank. And about 3 years later, she saw in the paper that I was coming back to speak in Pacific Palisades, and she remembers what I said about Scully. So she calls my office and talks to my secretary program manager, Linda Long, and she said, I wonder if Jim would mind if I tried to make some arrangements for him to have a cup of coffee with Vin Scully. And Linda said, "Oh, nothing would ever please him more." Well, she said, "I think I'll try then." And so she writes a letter to Scully introducing herself and me and tells him that, you know, that he was my childhood hero. And Scully writes back and said, "I'd be happy to have a cup of coffee with him."
At this point, you don't know anything about this, right?
I know nothing about it. And I get this phone call, and this woman introduces herself, and she said, "I know that you're going to be speaking out here January 30th, and Jim, I hope you don't mind, but I've made arrangements, a cup of coffee with Vin Scully." And you could have knocked me over with a pin. I had all I could do not to break down sobbing from the pure goodness of that exchange.
Where did you have coffee? Where did you meet him?
We met at the little local newspaper, the Pacific Palisades Post, I think was the name of it. And Janet was with me, and then there was a local photographer from the paper was there. And he took a picture of us getting together. And then we walked down the street to a coffee shop, and we sat out on the little patio, and we had a cup of coffee, and we talked Dodger Blue. I had a chance to ask him all of the questions that I would have loved to ask him all through the years. Where were you when Bobby Thompson hit the home run? And the famous announcing on that game was from Russ Hodges, who was doing the Giant play-by-play. The Giants win the pennant! The Giants win the pennant!
The Giants win the pennant!
Did the Dodgers have play-by-play for that game, and who was at the mic? And as it turned out, he explained that Red Barber was at the mic, and he was at Barber's elbow. And he said to me, he said, "I was glad that I was not announcing at that moment, because it would have been very difficult for a 22-year-old kid to handle that important a moment and not let emotions carry you away." Red Barber, I asked him, what was your relationship with Barber? And he said it was very much of a father-son relationship, that Barber was his mentor and he was very fatherly toward him, but he was also a stern taskmaster. And I said, well, can you give me an example? And he said, yes, at some point, I was very effusive in my praise for Willie Mays. And after the game, Red Barber took Scully aside and he said, you haven't announced long enough and Mays hasn't played long enough to warrant those kinds of words in a broadcast.
Did you ask him what his high point was as a baseball announcer?
I think he said on one of the Koufax broadcasts.
It is 9:46 p.m. 2-2 to Harvey Keene. One strike away. Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch. Swung on and missed. A perfect game.
What he did was announce that final play and then take the microphone and face it toward the crowd and walk to the back of the booth and let the reaction of the crowd tell the rest of the story.
That's a very humble thing for someone like that to do. You know, when you think about it, the opportunity to sit in front of an open mic and use it and think, well, I got to tell me what's going on, just to sort of back away and let the crowd tell the story.
On the scoreboard in right field, it is 9:46 p.m. in the City of the Angels, Los Angeles, California. And a crowd of 29,139. Just sitting in to see the only pitcher in baseball history to hurl four no-hit, no-run games.
What was it like hearing the voice that was so familiar coming out of the face that was unfamiliar, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. The accent was the same. And it was eerie. It was like, I can't believe that I'm sitting here with this guy.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Jim Trelease had a great time that day with his hero. He got an autograph and some great stories as well. But remember, this all came as a surprise. A stranger had arranged the meeting, and though Vin Scully didn't know Jim, he did say yes to coffee. And even though that event happened years ago, it has stayed with Jim.
With 24/7 news coverage, what we hear basically is that the world is either a very great place filled with great famous people, or it's an awful place where awful people do awful things to each other, when in fact, very little of the world is great or awful. Most of it is in between, where there are people doing good things to each other and for each other that aren't newsworthy. Scully did not have to give up his time, but he did. And he did something that made someone very, very happy.
Any one Scully call that you have memorized that you used to do from the outfield as a kid?
Oh, yeah. That one I did earlier. Bobby Snyder at the plate. It's a long drive to center field. Trelease in the outfield going back. Back to the wall. Forget it. I did that on West End Playground so many times that I don't know if Scully could do it any better.
One ball and no strikes. Aaron waiting. The outfield deep and straight away. Fastball is a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone.
Jim Trelease joined me from a studio in Amherst, Massachusetts. Special thanks to him for providing some of that vintage archival audio. If you carry around with you some of that vintage archival audio in your mind in the form of a story, get in touch with me. Let me know. I'm at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
This story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.